Following Chris Thomas's sacking as Infrastructure Minister, his subsequent resignation as Chair of the Housing and Communities Board, and a three-month hiatus in housing leadership, David Ashford has emerged as the new housing head. We'll hear from outgoing Chair of the Housing and Communities Board, Chris Thomas, shortly, but can David Ashford expand on the work already undertaken by the Housing Board?
Well, I've always viewed the board as the linchpin of housing policy across government. We now know that various different types of policy across government tend to be disparate. It tends to be divided up by the departments. I've always seen the purpose of the Housing Communities Board to draw everything in centrally to ensure that housing policy is delivered in a joined up way. Housing policy sits across various different departments. People always forget that even DHSC has a stake in housing policy. There's obviously DOI, which people always think about, but it's also wider than that. There's also ties in with homelessness as well, and people who might be sofa surfing. And I've always viewed the board as that linchpin of being able to pull everything together and saying, how do we deliver in a strategic way?
Does it have any powers, any sort of legislative power or a budget to spend?
So there was a budget given to the board when I was Treasury Minister of £2 million. I'm sure Chris will talk in a bit more detail around how the terms of reference all worked in relation to that were developed afterwards. But there is funding for the board to be able to drive things forward. It is about developing policy and bringing it to Tim Ward and actually getting approval. And if there needs to be legislative change, which I believe in terms of housing legislation, there does need to be. I've said that for many, many years, that all of our housing legislation needs to be joined up in a more modern act, then that is obviously something for Parliament.
So, Chris Thomas, marks out of 10 for the new Chair of the Housing and Communities Board. Has David pretty much got that right?
Well, no, 10 out of 10 for David accepting the challenge. When the Chief Minister described the role after talking with me in the run-up to his election as Chief Minister, he had two aspects to the Minister of Housing, as he was calling it at that point. One aspect was to coordinate housing policy, and the other aspect was to do housing policy. By the time it got to the Housing and Communities Action Plan, the doing had been taken away. It had become coordination, because, as David has indicated, there's powers and budgets, much larger budgets and huge powers all over governments, all the places that David had mentioned, but also in Department for Enterprise, Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture, huge amounts of money to spend on housing and have been spending it on housing. So basically, I think the Housing and Communities Board volunteers, because that's what they are. None of them has ever taken a penny for attending since July 2022, from memory. Have done a huge job working with a very small group of officers, which became pretty much one part-time officer in May 2023. They've done a huge job in actually taking forward the development of concepts and policies, which I really hope I can support David to deliver in the next few years, because we have done a huge amount of work. David described it this morning as behind the scenes. Lots of people know about it because the Housing Communities Board know about it, and we have a Douglas councillor who serves in his own name on it. We have a leading estate agent. We have a leading lawyer. We haven't worked in the board so much. We've worked in working groups, and I hope we can talk about each of the topics: homelessness, empty properties, housing association, social housing, public housing, and all of the other things that we want to talk about, because we've made so much progress, and it would be great if David could carry it on. Work with the four members of the board who are left as volunteers, and perhaps come up with a new way of arranging housing policy.
One of the criticisms that I hear from time to time about these new boards, the Housing and Climate Change boards, are that in essence they appear to be set up as the Aunt Sally, if you like, the place at which stones can be thrown when things don't happen, but actually they haven't really got much teeth or much power to achieve or deliver policy.
Well, that's true. So the £2 million is actually a Treasury fund to which a department of government has to bid to Treasury to obtain. So as And the Treasury have set in the terms of reference, which we agreed, that the Housing Communities Board has to give an opinion before the departments consider. So it's a very bureaucratic process. So And also £2 million can't be used for anything that's in any way continuing and current revenue expenditure of anybody else. It's just for projects. Also, there was a very great hesitancy on Cabinet Office, which has been responsible for housing since 2020, to take on staff. So I wanted three people. I wanted a financial expert, I wanted a legal expert, and I wanted a housing expert as well. We ended up with the programme manager who had to coordinate those sorts of things. We didn't end up with those other three experts. So there's been a reluctance to take on staff. So it is a hard job, but I do think it'll emerge in the next 40 minutes or so that we've actually made great progress, and there's a very solid bedrock for David and his colleagues to build on to solve some of the real housing problems. And as I say, full respect to David for accepting the challenge, full respect to the Housing Board members for volunteering so enthusiastically and so talentedly, and thank you very much to the staff, the three staff who've been particularly involved in the time when I was involved.
And I suppose then, if we've identified that these boards, the particularly in this case the Housing and Communities Board, is it's more than a talking shop, but it doesn't have the powers to actually deal with the housing crisis that you all described during the 2021 election, is now the time, with a new chair of the board going in, to actually say we need to improve and rationalise these bureaucratic structures that Chris Thomas has described?
Well, I think we should always be rationalising bureaucratic structures where they're identified. I've always been a firm believer in that. I mean, just adding to what Chris has said, I think one of the things Chris was very good at as chairman of the Housing Communities Board was actually standing up and fighting his corner in Tynwald, actually pushing forward, being very public about the challenges that were being faced. And I think that's the role as well as chairman of that board, is to actually challenge back to government and the departments, and actually say, this is what you're doing at the moment. There's a wider strategic picture. There's wider issues here. We need to be doing things differently. I see that as the role. That's one of the reasons for having lay people on the board as well, to get a wide range of views across the housing sectors on the island and actually bring that expertise in. That is the purpose of it. So it's not just a talking shop. I wouldn't describe the Climate Change Board as a talking shop either. But it's there for challenge just as much as anything else, and to be actually challenging government to say we need to do things differently, this is the way that we believe it needs to be done, and putting that challenge to councillor ministers and also to Tynwald.
But as you have rightly pointed out earlier in the programme, I remember as very briefly a housing minister, and you as member for housing for Douglas Borough Council as they were then, we had this conversation and we both had identified that the Housing Act was woefully out of date and needed to be upgraded. I set that as a priority for the next department, and here we are, 7 years since I left the DOI, and there doesn't appear to have been much, if any, movement on a new housing bill coming through.
Yeah, I mean, the Housing Act obviously dates from 1955, so clue is in the name, 1955, long, long time ago, post-war. Things have radically changed since then. During my time as chairman of housing on Douglas Council, 5 years I spent as chairman of housing, and I think during that time, Phil, I think I had seven different government members over those 5 years who were responsible for housing. So I think consistency sometimes has been a problem as well. And I think at least that's one thing the Housing Communities Board can also do, is try and provide a consistency of challenge without things necessarily changing every time the personnel changes.
Chris Thomas, I mean, you've had the ability to start working on new housing legislation. Is that a priority in terms of where you had got in relation to the Housing Board?
Yes, certainly it is. And just to remind you, there have actually been two major pieces of legislation put on the statute book since you're remembering. So the Landlord and Tenant Act now needs to be brought into force at some time. And secondly, Minister Hooper got through a private members bill, which is hugely significant. And also, I suppose you could add to that, Mrs Maltby also took forward an additional bill alongside that, which the department took over.
And you say hugely significant in what
in term in changing the relationships between freeholders and people who have leasehold properties, and in terms of management companies for property. So there's a huge amount of property work to do. We miss party wall legislation, we miss natural light legislation. We've got powers that we can use in primary legislation that haven't been used. So there's a huge need to modernise in certain places the primary legislation. For instance, I'll give you an example. You know, we can make policy national policy, but there's no, that's what the law says. We can make national policy, which is a pretty bad way of expressing law. It says that we have to go out and consult local authorities. All local authorities are housing, are involved in that, even if they don't have any houses of their own. You know, is that the way to do it? So there's some there are some fundamental pieces in the primary legislation we need to change, but more importantly, we need to get secondary legislation and policy in place as quickly as possible. So behind the scenes, we have got a mid-rent policy ready to go. We have, I hope, a report in October to meet David's and my expectations about public sector housing and shared equity and the future and indexing thresholds and so on. I haven't seen it. I don't know if you've seen it as yet. But, you know, we were both promised that by October. I do worry that more rapid reform has meant that there's been a focus on other things rather than delivering real things like the report that Tim Wood was promised in October. But anyhow, that's mid-rents one example. We've got to make the standards that will apply inside private rental housing under the landlord-tenant bill. If we do move towards empowering regional bodies to deliver housing with lots of money to provide new housing and meet homelessness obligations, we're going to need performance standards, which can be made under the Local Government Act 1985 Section 4A. We need to set those standards, and that was very much work in progress for me. But it hasn't been the legislative priority for the Department of Infrastructure. That's actually been marine infrastructure because of gas and wind turbines. And in any case, pretty much all of the legal drafters were taken out of the Department of Infrastructure and the drafters with this new policy of moving people over to the Attorney General's chambers.
But they're on the way back now, aren't they?
Who knows? Yeah. I mean, you've obviously heard that in political circles, and obviously that's what was recommended to us, and I think we accepted the recommendation, but I'm not sure I've seen any arriving into the sea terminal recently.
So then one of the few big announcements, I when I interviewed the Chief Minister, I was led to believe, I felt anyway, that there were going to be lots of big announcements at the Isle of Man Government Conference. One of the ones that I could, well, actually, I mean, the government's PR team only described three, and one of them was a housing association. So what do we understand about this? Because again, when I quizzed the Chief Minister, he seemed suitably vague before the Isle of Man Government Conference. So did whoever made the announcement give absolute clarity about what a housing association should be, how it was all going to work?
So let's go back to settled Tynwald policy. June 2020, Tynwald resolved that we should have a national, we should integrate national housing strategy, policy and law, and we should investigate the establishment of one or more housing associations or similar. That's settled Tynwald policy since 2020, okay? We have made good progress in the last decade with things like regional waiting lists, with understanding, you know, Douglas's housing stock, Ramsay's housing stock, with working with some excellent housing officers around the island. And I think we've achieved a great deal in the last decade to begin to set ourselves up to have a better organisation of public housing interfacing with private housing in terms of regulation, so that we can now deliver what Tynwald resolved we should deliver in June 2020. So the Chief Minister became very excited having met Andy and when he went down to Jersey, and having brought over another UK housing association, about the concept of the large-scale UK housing associations. So what I did was I persuaded the Chief Executive of Department of Infrastructure to commission some research using her powers. So it's only 16 days or something like that work, due by the end of July, and that report is now published, and it has five options for housing association. Option five, which is probably a really good one, is actually building on Ramsay's strength and the ability to work with northern parishes, and Douglas's strength and the ability to work with government on a huge scale. And the new, you know, in the south, you've now got one body for all of the sheltered arrangements, which is a huge amount of progress. So option five is very attractive. Then we put down option one and two, which is we consider having one or more new form legal concepts to get more houses and to do more things like help people when they leave care, homelessness, mid-rent, all those structures. And then, you know, the Chief Minister's options are three and four, which is having a UK parent coming in to be involved with those. Well, I think already the UK idea, the UK parent idea, is dead in the water. And I think the idea of having...
And what? Why is that?
Well, I just think that the people who really know about housing know there's lots of strength in places like Douglas City Council and Ramsay Town Commissioners, and we've got to work together to draw that out like we've been doing for 10 years. And secondly, I think that the idea number one, which is actually what the consultants recommended, which is just converting the 1,200 DOI properties and systems into a housing association, isn't gathering a lot of momentum, because it looks like, you know, Manx Care Mark II, and Manx Care seems to be perceived to be having problems at the moment. So I do think David's exactly the right person, because we've got to go and talk, which is what I would have been doing already in August, talk to Douglas Borough Council, Ramsay Town Commissioners, Peel Town Commissioners, Castletown Town Commissioners, Port Erin, Port St Mary, Braddon, and anybody else I've forgotten that's really active in the housing world, and actually working together so that we can get the tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions, over the next decade to do what needs to be done for housing. And David's much better than that I am, because he's closely connected with Treasury Minister, I should think.
Former.
I think Chris is being a bit modest there. Just to add to that, Phil, I think, you know, the important point Chris has made there is we need to be working together. I mean, that was something you mentioned when your time, when you were housing member, you tried to do very much, was work with the local authorities. There's vast amount of experience out there across the island in those local authorities. We need to be tapping into that, not ignoring it. We need to be listening to them, listening to the problems they have, and because they are the problems on the ground for the tenants and people who are experiencing and trying to resolve those issues. So one of the first things I do want to do, Chris will be delighted to hear, is actually go out and speak to the housing authorities, actually hear from them firsthand about the challenges that they're facing and what they believe is the options to be able to fix it. In terms of housing associations, I was around in the UK when housing associations first came into being there, and, you know, I've always been quite blunt about it. I saw some that, if you look at them, were done very well, very good models, and then other models that, to be quite frank, just didn't work and have been pretty much a disaster ever since. There's been some housing associations that have piled on debt, if you look across the UK. Whether or not realistically that debt will ever be repaid is another matter. So I think, you know, what matters to me is the detail of what we're doing and what we are calling a housing association, because they come in different forms. And I think if you've got six people in a room and ask them what's a housing association, you probably get at least four different answers. And that's the kind of detail that we need to develop.
And one of the problems that you will face, of course, is that each of the existing housing authorities owns property, and they take the view that it's their property, and how dare government come in and start interfering with their houses. You can kind of understand that sort of thinking, because each of the local authorities is established as a separate legal entity. So they have almost a duty to defend what's theirs. But quite clearly, I mean, I've made this point before, and it doesn't do me any favours as clerk to Russian commissioners with our four houses. But, you know, it is quite ridiculous in the constituency of Russian. We've got five housing authorities. Where does, you know, particularly an elderly person who potentially could go into the elderly housing complex, they could go into Port St Mary, they could go to Russian, they could go to Port Erin, they could take on the DOI housing, they could be on the DOI housing list. It is possibly in need of reform, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that's where one of the things, actually, I think it was under your time as Minister for DOI that came in, the shared lists came in, very handy, actually, for people to be able to transfer through. From my point of view, this is why it's about working together. it shouldn't be about an us and them. That's certainly not something I want to see develop whatsoever. One of the things with the Tolson report that's going before Tim Wood, one of the options that was in there was for, you know, local authorities to be included in any housing association. That's not the option that is going before Tim Wood. You know, I don't think we should be trying in any way to drive local authorities in one direction. We need to listen to them. We need to go out and speak to them, see what their challenges are and work with them. This shouldn't be seen in any way as a takeover, because from my point of view, it shouldn't be that.
So obviously housing associations, you know, the structure and the design is one thing to be discussed. But in terms of a young person who is really struggling to find somewhere to live at an affordable rent, or indeed trying to buy somewhere, what benefit does a housing association bring?
Well, this is the other side of housing policy as well. So housing associations come obviously more from the social housing, or we don't use that these days, as Chris will correct me. I still say it's still been around far too long, the public housing. You know, there's obviously the other things as well, where you've got people who will want affordable rental. There's been lots of work I know Chris has been doing around the rental sector as well, and around first-time buyers and even second-time buyers and beyond. So that's work that I think we need to continue on, and I want to try and push forward, because there's many different facets to housing policy, and those are the things that people see on the ground. I said on the Manx Radio breakfast show this morning that, you know, if we're going to attract people back to the island and deliver on the other parts of the island plan, like encouraging more people into the island, ensuring we can get teachers, doctors, nurses, police officers who bring in families with them, encourage our young people back to the island, then we need to ensure we have the right type of housing, but also housing that is affordable, be it rental or looking to purchase. So all of those aspects of housing policy are absolutely crucial if this administration is going to deliver.
And just to build on that, something that David said was really important. Basically, I think what went wrong in 2013 to 2014-15 was that Minister Robert Shaw was perceived as forcing something into the regions, and what we're now doing and what we need to do is we need to work with people to work out what's best for the north and for the south and for the Central Valley. So that's it's a very important difference. The second point is, I would challenge you that Onchan District Commissioners own Onchan District Commissioner housing. It's been paid for over decades, including deficiency payments and by past rent payers of public housing. It's not as simple. Legally, it's clearly simple that they own it, but it's not the fact. You know, it's been paid for by taxpayers, deficiency payments over the decade. It's been paid by generations, in some cases, of people paying rents. So it's there for the future of public housing. The next point is that David's got some really difficult questions to answer as soon as possible about the future of public sector housing, and David and I worked together in House of Keys, Tim Wood, on this. So, for instance, more than half the people in public housing are now on fixed-term tenancies. At some point, we've got to make a decision about whether all people move to fixed-term tenancies, and the local authorities all told me that it had to be the housing chair or the Minister for Infrastructure or Housing who had to make that announcement, and then we need to draw up a transition time. Once we've made that announcement, we then need to make sure we get inside everybody's head so that they understand what their future looks like, and we have to make decisions about how rents will be determined, because the housing association debate has already been mixed up with the fact that in Jersey and across, rents are much higher than they are here for public housing. Settled Tim Wood policies in the means testing principles is that we can afford to have higher rents only when we have a benefit system that actually targets people who need it more. And so, you know, if David's bold enough, he can announce that rents will be going up by a lot, but then if you are genuinely struggling, you will get means tested payments from Treasury. That's what the means testing principles say. We've also got to move to new forms, and that's what mid-rent is all about. We've got to allow people who are in public housing to actually be building up a deposit so that they can move into private rent, owned houses, if that's what they want. And so we need to rethink systems along those lines, and I hope there's lots of work there. It should be the case that we've surveyed in August and September, the percentage of people and what's happening to them on fixed term tenancies a year on from when we did it last. So you should be given the data, unless it's all been messed up with more rapid reform and focus on other issues. You should be given the data a year on to see how things have changed.
He's very mischievous, this format.
He's always mischievous.
I mean, in terms of public sector housing rentals, where are we comparatively with, I don't know, parts of the UK or Ireland? Are we relatively low in terms of public sector housing rents, or are we on the high side, or where do we fit in that?
I've looked at this quite a bit, and as a backbencher, and also when I was a Douglas councillor, and it is quite hard to draw comparisons between the other jurisdictions because they're very different systems in place, both in terms of how rents are decided and charged, but also the benefits system that sits behind that. Chris made a very important point about the benefits available as well to people at a lower down, and with an impact on the rents as well. So I've never been able to get a direct comparison because it's a bit like comparing apples and pears. I would say the nearest I ever really got it back when I looked when I was chairman of Douglas Housing was we were sort of about midpoint across the UK in terms of rent at that time. I genuinely don't know what it would be now. I can go back and try and look at my Excel sheet again and try and calculate it through. But certainly at that time, we were a level. One of the things that Chris touched on there that is absolutely crucial is comparative data. We mentioned about the data sets, and that's what we need to do. We need to actually be seeing year on year what is changing, what is the impact on people, and are things actually improving for them? And we've got to have that comparative data set, because otherwise you can't have anything to make decisions off going forward. It was one of my biggest bugbears when I used to be minister at DHSC, was the lack of data. And certainly when it comes to making housing, long-term housing decisions, you need that data underpinning. So for me, it is important that we do have those comparative data sets being compiled.
And in July, I think it's about, we're about midway, just as David says, in terms of comparable ones in the north of England. But if you compare us to Jersey, our public rents are a third or something of what they are, but they have a completely different system. They pay 80% of Jersey market rents, and then lots of people get social security payments to make up the difference. So that's a completely different system, so it's not comparable. But look, let's summarise this housing association issue then. So the way I see it, the challenge that David has got with the Housing and Communities Board, if he wants to keep them, I mean, they're a bit frustrated that they do all of this stuff in their free time, you know, without all of the information, because they're not civil servants. We used to meet every 2 weeks in the Housing Communities Board. We had a major speech from an officer just before he had to leave in March about how, you know, it was frustrating from an officer's point of view because they were just coordinators and they could never get departments to do what needed to be done. I had a major speech from one of the board members in April meeting that, you know, they had to rely on what officers were telling them because they didn't have enough time to devote to all of the different intricacies and nuances of DEFA politics and policy and Treasury politics and policy and all of that sort of stuff. So it's a very frustrating role. But look, a housing association can be, if it's prepared the right way, can help more houses be built, which is fundamental, can get more money out of Treasury for housing, which is fundamental, and basically we can move to more rational policy decisions using the 6,200 houses we have in the public sector in a better way, you know, for the right purposes. We've also got more fundamental challenges in housing, like what to do with the empty properties, what to do with our homeless people, how to enable people to buy their own homes and to have an efficient conveyancing process. And I do hope we can carry on talking about some of those sorts of initiatives as well.
Yeah, well, before we do, I don't want to move off the rental sector before we discuss the landlords and tenants legislation. And, you know, there is a marked difference between public sector housing rents and private sector housing rents. Part of the move or part of the fear amongst landlords about the introduction of the legislation, which, as you've described, is on the statute book but hasn't been brought into force, is that a whole load of new regulation is going to be introduced for landlords. And as a result, a number of tenants are finding that their landlords have decided they're going to get out of the rental market and they're giving notice to their tenants. Is that just a short-term blip, do you think, or is that an area of, you know, you've tried to do a good in one area and then created a harm in another? I don't know who would want to. David.
I'll take it first. I mean, it was a concern I had at the time, actually, with the Act. Obviously, I was in Council of Ministers at the time, but it was a concern I shared because I'd heard from landlords who said, well, depending upon what we now have to do, we've only got one or two properties, they're mortgaged anyway. We're not making huge money off them. If it becomes too onerous, what's the point? We'll invest elsewhere. I think it's something we need to actually monitor. But with the Tenants and Landlords Bill, the devil was always going to be in the detail, and that meant that the regulations were going to be absolutely key. So we've got to make sure that the regulations that come off the back of this have the right balance in terms of protection for the tenant, which was the whole purpose of the bill as well, but also protection for the landlord, in terms of ensuring we don't actually scared the small landlords off, who decide, well, it's just had enough, it's too onerous, we're going to pack in. So it's getting that difficult balance right, and those regulations are going to be absolutely crucial to that.
And of course, Chris Thomas, I mean, the purpose of the bill it was primarily to address what could only be described as scandalous conditions that some rental properties are in.
So let's break this down. It's always hard to establish causality. What caused what in socio-economic terms? So simultaneously with the Landlord and Tenant Act being on the statute book but not enforced, we've had rising interest rates at the same time as rising prices. So if your mortgage goes from 1% to 5%, and if you see your property being valued a lot more than it was a few years ago, you're quite likely to sell it in any case regardless. You might want to blame Landlord and Tenants Act, but it's also there's quite a lot of financial factors. That's the first point. The second point, let's break down into setting standards and raising standards into two separate issues. To me, it's obvious, and I think I've persuaded senior officers around government of this, it's obvious, and I think the Housing Communities Board would accept this, it's obvious that the same standards when it comes to environmental health, fire, all of those sorts of things should be in place for the public sector as for the private sector. And I think that the easiest way to move that forward would be to choose a date when it becomes clear that the same standards are in force, and have the same date for bringing it in for the public sector as for the private sector. So we can do it for the public sector. We've never done it for the public sector, but we can do it under the Local Government Act 1985, section 4A from memory, which talks about standards. We can set them for the public sector, and we can set them for the private sector under the Landlord and Tenants Act.
So the first stage is
just identifying all the standards and specifying them equally across the place. That's quite easy.
And the public would. I think any casual observer would think, well, surely to goodness, if you're going to introduce standards, they should apply across government.
So I've won the argument take it forward and do it.
But of course, the answer coming back from government has often been, well, you can trust us because we're the government, although that doesn't always...
And government's wrong, and people are right, and that's got to be in place. And to raise the standards then, we then have a transition period to get to them, and that's where the private sector's been right. We've got to have money in place. David's got to be effective in persuading the Treasurer not to focus on paying for rich people's electric cars and electric boilers and air source heat pumps. He's got to focus on basic standards so that the vast number of empty properties are brought up to the standard. And there's legal frameworks that can be used. There's a thing called the Empty Dwellings Management Order, where the ownership stays with the person, but as long as you make pledges about bringing something back into use, you can get access to public funds and let it be managed by the public sector. And we've got to be using those to bring these substandard properties up to the standard, and we should stop focusing on the richer people in the energy transition, but the really people living in damp, leaky, cold conditions.
Yeah, if you haven't got a home that is suitable for living in, then that affects every aspect of your life. I've been on the public record before, so I can actually say it. I've always believed the standards between public sector and private sector should be the same. I've never understood this argument about it should be two levels. I've stated that many times. I think I've even done it in an interview with you at one point, Phil, a long time ago.
I'm sure you did.
That I've always believed that. I've never understood the argument that says the two should be separate. So I'm actually on board with Chris with that. I've always believed the two should be aligned.
So let's just imagine it. Let's just say that something like just before the next election in 2026, we have a Tim Ward where we set performance standards for local authorities under the Local Government Act, and we bring the landlord and tenant in force. And so the next job in the next few months is actually going through working with DEFA, the fire service, everybody else that sets standards, and saying, we'll just agree that we'll put the existing standards into law now, and then we'll work out what needs to be done to raise them where they need to be done, and then we'll get the money from Treasury and Tim Wood to actually put in place loan arrangements, grant arrangements, penalty powers if you don't fulfil the pledges that you've made, to bring things back into use. Because it's wrong to just think of new builds. We've got to, the public perceives that there are 6,000 houses out there that can be used better. I think they're not quite right. I think lots of those are investment properties and holiday homes and all and things for when you retire and all of that. So it's a bit more complicated than it first seems, and we've done some good research on that. But there are lots of properties that can be brought up to standard and can be used better.
And that is a very good point. You know, it's about utilising the stock that's already there. When people talk about housing, it always tends to focus on new builds. And Chris is quite right. There is a cohort of properties out there that we could be using better on the island, and we need to start using better.
Just on the new build then, what sort of message does it put across when government decides that it's going to invest millions of taxpayers' money in private sector developments to develop luxury flats?
If this is referring to obviously to the brownfield sites announcement, I think the Chief Minister made, brownfield sites, we have had sites sat around this island that have been undeveloped for many, many years. There are some sites where it is just not, in many cases, financially viable for the private sector to step in and do it with no support whatsoever. Those are the sites that the Chief Minister was referring to. I believe it is the right approach to be trying to get those sites developed, because, you know, you can't win if you don't do it. Then they sit there as an eyesore and everyone complains and says, look, that's a site that's sat there for 20 years, nothing's happening. If you do it, then you get the allegation that there's taxpayers' money being used to subsidise luxury flats. I actually think what we're looking at is actually ensuring though that land gets back into use, because there is too many sites sitting around. As a Douglas MHK, you know, I can go to mention Summerland, Park Road, the nurses' homes now being done, but there's also Victoria Road, the old prison site. There's lots of different sites in our nation's capital that, to be quite frank, are in eyesores, and we need to get them back into use.
And a number of those are in government ownership, and government, could quite easily invest those millions in their own sites and get those back into reasonable.
Well, you've got to have something to build on it in the first place, and I think sometimes the private sector is much better at delivering those sort of schemes than government is, to be frank. One of the things, though, I would say as well is I've always been a huge supporter that when government is due to exit a site, normally they know for several years before. And I've never understood why there isn't plans put in place at that point when you're thinking, right, that building in 5 years' time is going to be vacant. What are we doing with the site afterwards? It always seems to get worried about after the site's been vacant for 5 years or more. And that has always been something that's frustrated me.
The old prison site, for example, Victoria Road prison, it was... clearly, I mean, the Department of Home Affairs presented a case to demolish, which included their expert that said it should be registered, which was quite bizarre. But anyway, that the prison has been demolished and nothing's happening on that site.
So clearly brownfield sites need using. I'll do two, because they make you talk about two examples of sites, just because they make the case I'm going to try to make. And that is the prison site and Park Road. Well, both of those sites are sort of blighted by political indecision in other areas. So the Department of Home Affairs is clinging on to the prison site because it's, you know, some people there still have dreams about a blue light hub and new uses because it's close to the thing and new fire stations and all of that. So that's just blighted by political indecision. So the decision that needs to be made by the Chief Minister and senior ministers and Tim Wood is, are we going to have a blue light hub? Is that site necessary? And if not, Department of Infrastructure could have sold that site I'm told, 15 times in the last decade for private development, but they're never able to because other departments always have a claim on it and it might be used. It's a bit like St George's football ground when they took over the rugby ground and the Braddon one. They always might be useful for something else, so they never get released because they might be useful. So we've got to have, it goes back to good planning. And the second one is Park Road. You know, if you believed the political consensus in Keys and Tynwald, you know, Castle Rushen High School redevelopment is the most important thing in education. In actual fact, there are some schools in central Douglas that have got much more profound problems than Castle Rushen has. And the reason why Park Road is blighted is the East Area Plan for the East makes it quite clear that until we've located where the central Douglas school is going to be, we can't release that site. And so we've got to make a decision. Are we going to have a new primary school in central Douglas? If not, where are we going to start doing things? And if so, is it going to go in the DHA building on the edge of Cronkbourne? Is it going to go on Park Road? Is it going to go on the promenade? We've got to choose the site for it. That's what good planning is all about, because again, the Department of Infrastructure could have developed Park Road site over the last decade, and it could have sold it for other people to develop over and over, but there's this planning restriction on the education use.
And this is where strategic thinking is key. So for instance, there's been various talk, as Chris said, about Park Road site, about it being a school, but my understanding is with that site you'd only get a single form year school on that site. So do you really want to be building that smaller school and the capacity issues that could come further down the road? These are all things where strategic decisions should be made early. When a site is due to become vacant, you mentioned there the prison site, Phil. You know, 10 years beforehand, everyone knew that prison was effectively going to go, but nothing was planned for the site afterwards. And that then does, as Chris say, encourage sort of the hugging of the site and the protection of the site. I remember when I was chairman of Housing and Douglas Council, I had a lot more hair than I do now, so it was quite a while ago. There was talk about building a care home on the site, with first time buyers extending down extending Victoria Terrace, as it is now, along the whole back of it. That never came to anything. I remember going to a presentation again when I was a councillor of the Park Road site. There was going to be mixed housing use. Chris will probably remember that one. Again, came to nothing. We need to have strategic development across all the sites. And we need to move from, as Chris say, you know, maybe useful to making things useful.
And that's two things that the Housing and Communities Board has achieved. One is commissioned and paid for a development viability study, which is basically the intellectual underpinning for everything that the Island Infrastructure Scheme and Manx Development Corporation is doing, because it actually assessed independently the costs of developing some of these brownfield sites. That's never been published. There'll never be any public credit for it because it's not the sort of thing that can be published, but the Housing Communities Board paid for the Cabinet Office to commission a development viability study on these brownfield sites. And the second thing is we've paid and commissioned with Cabinet Office an objective assessment of housing need, which you'll say is Douglas right, that Douglas City Council right, that the focus in the capital should be two bedroom properties and so on. It actually looks at it objectively and comes up with conclusions about the type of housing, the number of housing, the location and all those things. And that's two things that we've done behind the scenes. I think the objective assessment of housing need will be published soon, I hope so, but I can't imagine the viability study ever being published because of the nature of it.
I'd love to go into the Manx Development Corporation in a bit more detail, but before the programme ends, I do want us to discuss homelessness and how the Housing and Communities Board can assist with that.
So if I go first then, essentially soon after the beginning of this year, one of the members of the Housing Communities Board was actually the officer who was responsible for all of this in DHSS, as it used to be, back in 15 years ago. So, and she was, I think, at the time, Housing Matters, what's now Housing Matters, was set up. So, you know, we've known for 15, 20 years what needed to be done. It's just we haven't managed to do it as yet. And what needs to be done is we need to sort of get inside people's lives themselves and help them have a home around themselves so they can hold down job and relationships. And so we need to get to that. It's not about having a shelter for a shelter's sake and being good. And so she persuaded us not just to focus on a shelter. She wanted us to have it DHSC led, to actually think about a process linking in with housing authorities, local authorities, to house people, to help people and all of that. So that strategy was developed. It was taken to the Council Minister's subcommittee. It was taken to the Housing Committee Board, all approved. We also set up a working group of all the people who'd applied to provide those services in about 2020. That working group's been meeting. I think they're getting a bit frustrated in the working group because things haven't been happening for the last 3 months.
And why is that?
Because you
resigned.
I depoliticised it by not staying on it. I let the that person chair it and the groups. And I think that strategy is now refined. I think it was got hold of by one department of government. I'm not going to name them to pour oil onto the fire, but it was got hold of by one department of government who said it had to have more indicators in it and it had to have a more definite action plan. But the whole point was, you know, the indicators come from once you've decided what you're going to do, if you see what I mean. And we've got to get the actual budget that's needed to do what that group wants to do, which is to actually have, you know, four-bedroom halfway houses to help people rebuild their lives, not a hostel with everybody who's got any sort of challenge bunged together into one place and all of that. So therefore, I think there must be people behind the scenes who are trying to get the budget. I would spend the whole of what's left of David's £2 million and the extra £1 million that Dr. Allenson gave us on the homelessness response and actually working with these bodies to put together a homelessness response. And I think that's action number one. And action number two is actually introducing, perhaps even in the local government amendment bill that's before the House of Keys at the moment, a homelessness obligation on somebody. And I hope it can be on regional housing bodies, so somebody up north is responsible for the problem up north and somebody down south. And I hope that DHSC Wellbeing Partnerships can work with Housing Matters and the other charities so that we have a person-centred, friendly doorway into a well-organised system.
Yeah, when it comes to homelessness is not one size fits all. It's very important we continue to develop the night shelter and the shelter option, but that is a safety blanket. As Chris rightly says, we need to understand what the challenges are for different individuals. One of the ones we haven't touched on, for instance, and which I asked a question about recently, was in relation to domestic violence, people fleeing relationships with children, potentially. You can't really put them into a shelter. It's not an appropriate environment for them. But if they don't qualify for public housing, then they've got nowhere to go and they may end up going back into that abusive relationship just to keep a house over their children's head. So there's all those sorts of challenges that are built into homelessness as well. And so it is important we don't take a one-size-fits-all approach and we actually look at what different individual people actually need and be able to give that support.
So the 2008 homelessness legislation across was built into a piece of regulation to do with having a second go at the emergency loans in the social security system. And that's there to be replicated somewhere in the Local Government Act. So, for instance, what that says is you've got to be resident in the Isle of Man, so you can't get on a boat in Liverpool, come here and immediately get eligible. You've got to have some sort of established residency. And then it somehow looks at whether you've deliberately made yourself homeless. So if you're, you know, there are bad people everywhere, and somehow you have to have tests to make sure that you are really homeless. It's not just that you've set up in your mobile home in an industrial estate somewhere temporarily until you get round a few more points and so on. So we do need systems in place around this.
Protections and checks.
So we've got 30 seconds or so left for each of you to describe what you would like to see happen over the next 2 or 3 years for the Housing and Communities Board. Start with you, David, because Chris waffles on forever.
Well, for me, I'll keep it blunt and straight to the point, exactly the same as I've said in the other media interviews. It's people seeing change on the ground, people actually seeing change that's impacting their lives and their friends and family, and they can actually see a benefit to them.
Well, Chris, you now have more than 30 seconds.
I don't need, I never do, just to talk substance. £200 million over 10 years.
£200 million on what?
And even then, you know, there are local authorities who will be disappointed that they're not going to get their 10-year plans financed with £200 million. But we need grants and loan and other arrangements to bring empty properties back into use. We need new legal mechanisms to work with people who have empty properties to help that. We need a rational, optimal organisation. You know, Onchan District Council have done themselves no favours by not joining a shared waiting list. Peel Town Commissioners have not done themselves no favours by not putting together a Western list. Both of those people I had really good meetings with, and I hope they come on board. But Ramsey Town Commissioners, Castletown, down south, Port Erin, Port St Mary, you know, you have a shared waiting list. Douglas has obviously got a lot more staff working in this and more properties than DOI. We need to come together and actually work out a rational way of convincing Treasury first, and then Tim Wood, that we need hundreds of millions effectively over the next decade to tackle housing.
Very concise and not even the slightest hint of waffle. That was MHK's Chris Thomas and David Ashford. Has there been enough action on housing by this government? Do you feel encouraged or perhaps concerned by what you heard on the programme? Don't forget, this programme is available as a podcast on Manx Radio's website. For now, though, I'm Phil Gorn, Goramayos and Geisha Chrome. Thanks for listening.